Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is the excited, the enigmatic, the one-note monotone, Mr. Spencer Williams.
One-note monotone? How dare you?
Oh, you should have heard him before. He's like, okay, let's do this.
There's no proof of that.
There is very much proof, and I'll actually talk about it in a second. And also, speaking of proof, we have with us Amy. Managing intern, because we got to figure out what is the actual title to your name. We gave you this new title and we can't even figure it out what it is. Is it managing intern, intern manager, Amy, whatever?
It seems what's a managing intern?
What's an Amy? No, just
what's a girl?
We have a great show in store as we are celebrating the cap of this month as
Thank
we
God.
Celebrated Cosmic Horror and Halloween with the final review of the month, and that is our take on In the Mouth of Madness. So stick around as we dive into that and talk about all the wonderful goodness that came out of that movie. But before we do, Spencer, give us them opening credits.
Tune into brand new episodes each and every week. On all your favorite streaming platforms and over on our website at filmosopherspodcast.com. Also, connect with us on Twitter and Instagram and Threads at filmosophy101. Also, we're on Blue Sky at Filmosophers Podcast.
That's right. We got a website. And if you head out over to our website at filmosopherspodcast.com, there we got allegedly over 300 episodes. Everything from action, anime, comedy, suspense, thrills and chills. If you're looking for it, we got it. Head on over to our website at filmlossverspodcast.com. You can also check us out over wherever podcasts are streaming, and that's iTunes, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, iHeart, and Amazon Music. Tune into your heart's desire on any one of those platforms. Look for us there at The Filmlossophers and give us a like or a subscribe. And if you like what you hear, give us a 5-star review. We've earned it.
We have.
Yes, please.
We are so excited to finish out this great month. And this has been an amazing month of movies and reviews and conversation. And, of course, all this wonderful goodness has been recorded over at our social pages. So we'll give you those social links at the end of the episode. But, yeah, as I was saying earlier, I was kind of triggered. We were going on air, and this is a little kind of pulling back the curtain a bit, but we were on, talking right
before.
Look at
the people behind the curtain.
We were talking a little bit before we went on air, and Spencer was just very much like,
no.
And he turns it on. I give him that. He turns it on. But I did remember, and we actually had a thorough conversation about this, and I forget, and if the intern wouldn't mind kind of start digging into our older episodes, we do have an episode called Spencer is the Grinch of Halloween.
Yeah, you call me the Halloween Grinch.
The Halloween Grinch. Yes. And it was because of why? What is it about the season that made... What was it? I don't even remember what the nature of that episode was, but you were just so negative about either Halloween or horror movies. You were just... It wasn't even like, this isn't my thing or whatever. It was just like, bah, humbug. Like you...
It is lesson 187, extra credit, the Halloween Grinch and horror movies.
Yes.
Yes.
And I think I actually have a picture...
From 6 years ago.
Yes.
Yep. Eddie will bring up something that happened 6 years ago because like it happened yesterday.
Because it lives on the internet, baby. It is there.
It is currently available on our website.
What does the description say? If we
had it says, the Filmlosophers sip their coffee and cider as they explore the wonder of Halloween. Well, into the autumn season, the fall fellas chat about their personal views of Halloween and how Spencer has become the Halloween Grinch. From dress up to holiday goodies, everything is laid out on the table to find where the root of his disdain orients. Plans are made, insults are thrown, and a truce is forged in this latest war of words. So grab your popcorn, put down your masks and makeup, and tune in to a new and exciting episode of Extra Credit.
You know, I really, really wish I had listened to that before today, because like I was thinking about this and I feel like something happened when I was a child that like just put me off it, but I'm not sure why. I think I was trying to be a little tough guy and be like, this stuff is boring and not scary. Ha ha ha. And I was actually very scared.
How long ago did you say that was?
It was October 11th of 2019.
Okay, so 6 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So yeah, pre-pandemic.
The before time.
The before time.
A whole lifetime ago.
When we were just like, everything is fine and the world will always be great. And then 2020 happened.
Yeah.
And everybody had to trick or treat, you know, from behind plastic.
Pretty much did happen.
Yeah, it was interesting because we were having just minor chat before the show, and Spencer was just in that kind of tonality, and it just triggered something. And I was like, I know we did an episode on this, and I was just like, it has to be somewhere. So I'm glad I was right. And I'm just like, I am beside myself for the fact that there is proof out there that Spencer is the Grinch of Halloween.
And you named him thusly.
It's not my fault. You proved me right.
Excuse me?
Did you even listen to that episode? Probably not.
I can't recall because this was Spencer's the before times.
I just recall, I know we were talking about, like, I think we were talking about traditions, and I think we were talking about things that we would do prior to, like, as kids or even as young adults in celebration of the holiday. And of course, today, when this episode drops, it will be Halloween. Mm-hmm. So we do hope that you are taking us along with you as you go about your Halloween festivities, your autumn jubilations, your however you want, your fall funness, whatever. We hope that you bring us along with you. But again, it's so funny that simple, like, intonation, certain things like that just trigger things. Seeing as it has been 6 years since that episode, which, by the way, what date? Like
October 11th of 2019. Okay.
So yeah, it's proper over 6 years ago.
Yeah.
How do you feel about Halloween now?
That's so interesting because I don't know if you want to talk about this now, because this actually kind of leads into the movie we're talking about.
Okay.
Because like,
he's crossing his arms, people. He's really kind of...
No, because this movie got me really thinking about, like, you, actually. Because, like, I realized this guy pulled me over to the side.
Yeah, I did. And it only took me 6 years, but I did it.
Because I was like, horror movies are awesome to me now.
Yes! Yes! I will take it.
Some of them are dumb, but, like, they're dumb in a fun way or an endearing way.
Aww,
so
still not me.
I mean, hey, six years, you know, just give me a little bit more time. But like, that's awesome. Cause again, it's one of those things where I know it was a pretty definitive conversation. And in doing so, we kind of talked about like your experience. And even, I think it was more so, I think you're right. I think it was more so in the mentality of like, just you feeling like you were too old for a lot of it, and so you just never got into it. It just wasn't your thing, you know, which is fine. But like, again, to your point, also being exposed to like some of the finer parts that kind of revolve around the holiday, specifically like horror movies, like having fun ones like that really do bring about a sense of like excitement and refreshed kind of energy towards it. So and hopefully one day Amy will come around.
No.
You know, I believe it. I feel it in my nuggets, as she would say.
Thank you for quoting one of my favorite movies that is not a horror movie. Surf's Up.
Switching gears over to Amy.
Oh.
What is it? So do you actually enjoy the holiday of this? Okay. What about it is it that you enjoy?
Not just the weather. Like, I appreciate we actually get seasons, so it's not like either super duper hot or super duper cold. And even then, it's, oh my gosh, my Miss Congeniality brain was like, all you need is a light jacket. I'm so sorry.
No.
I really do like the weather, but also kind of just the whole spirit of it. It doesn't have to be spooky, because it bridges so gently with autumn as a whole. It doesn't have to be macabre. There's a sense of the change, not only the changing of the seasons, but it's the wrapping things up.
But then that's just fall.
But this is also, but when you come to Halloween,
like,
if it's
just like, okay,
then
you're starting to celebrate in September, which is fine. But like, specifically,
yes, I would celebrate in
September. Specifically, I mean Halloween. I don't mean like, again, fall is fine. Autumn is whatever.
Okay,
it's what autumnal seasons, that's what it is. I'm talking about specifically Halloween. And this is why I asked, because Halloween is sacred to a lot of people. Like, I don't know how Spencer grew up, but like for my house and my upbringing and my tradition, you know, my ethnic traditions, there's a level of importance around the spiritual aspect of the universe. And even in the aspect of like, you know, celebrating those, honoring those who have passed, recognizing what that site is, and having fun on a day that is meant for community and family and togetherness. Like, if there's anything that stands out for Halloween for me, it is an opportunity for, yes, sometimes a little bit of, you know, spooks and frights, but never to the extent to where it's no longer fun. It's always in the effort of fun. It's always in the effort of tolerable. And then it's also in an effort to bring people together. Like, you go to anyone's house, you go to any mass gathering, and I remember it very vividly. One time, and this was during the church years of our life, when I was younger, when I was in high school, I remember going to a brother or a family friend, a church member's house who had kids, and it was a whole holiday thing. We were all there for like Christmas or something, and all the teenagers were gone. And someone came, and it's like they had a really big house, but it was like a bunch of people from the church. And someone came down to get me, and they're like, "Hey, we're all up here." And we went upstairs, and that's where I remember watching for the first Final Destination movie. It was during the holiday season, and there's literally like 15 to 20 teenagers packed in this one girl's bedroom with the door closed, lights off, on this small bulbous TV with the bootleg DVD of Final Destination. And I remember watching it, and I'm like, this is great. Like, we're all together just watching a scary movie. And it's, mind you, it's Christmas, but this is cool. And every other situation that followed up, like, that was at the beginning of the boom of like bootleg DVDs, because every sports trip, so every time I went to go play football, or every time I went to go play baseball, someone always brought three things: a pair of pliers, a DVD player, and one of those little satchels of like, or the
CD cases, like with DVDs.
Yes. You guys?
I'm so sorry, but can we talk about why were there pliers?
Oh, so when you go to hotels back in the day, because it's not the same anymore, but back in the day, they would not allow people to plug into the back of the TVs.
Well, yeah.
So right. on the back, do you remember the old film canisters? Like the old, like
the film roll canisters?
No, like the ones that you would like put into your little camera.
Oh, yes, those things.
So,
yeah.
So it looks like the plug on it looked like the bottom part of those film canisters with like a hole in the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would plug like the coax cable through that, and then it would like latch onto the TV. So you would have to use a pair of pliers to squeeze it off and pull it out. So that way you can plug into the back of the TV.
That's weird.
Yeah. The only reason why I know that is because all the times that we would have to go on trips, someone would bring the DVD player, and if somebody forgot to bring the pliers, someone else was usually bringing some. That's why I had gotten really into Leathermans back in high school, because it was always like, okay, you have a Leatherman and like just pop it off and then you can plug into the back. And so every time someone would do that, there would be a new bootleg movie that was still in theaters that somebody had that we were going to watch. Like the game was either on Saturday or it was on Friday night or whatever. So we would all get to the hotel, and either the next morning or that night before the game, we would all go to one guy's hotel room like really late, and then we would watch whatever movie was what they brought. So, but it was just like the community aspect. Like everybody was just coming together kind of to do that. And 9 times out of 10, it was usually a scary movie. Mm-hmm. So, but that's kind of what I think of when I think of Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
Now, going back to you, because you talked about autumn and fall.
You rounded that so far that I was just like, wait. We got to pliers. We got to Leatherman.
Yeah, because again, it's like you think of scary movies. You think of Halloween. Like both of those kind of go hand in hand because they usually do create a sense of community. You look at the horror community. The horror community is like vast, and they are all about supporting each other. Like it's funny, and this is a whole other conversation. But I 100% like wholeheartedly believe that like the horror community and the Magic the Gathering community are very close and very similar. Just in how
there's just a thin membrane between the two of you.
Yeah, one of them uses, you know, physical cards, and one uses a television and watches it on TV, but or in movies. But yeah, so what is it about Halloween?
Well, I was going to say the community, but not in the horror sense, because really, when I was a kid, the house that we lived at that I remember the fondest was, like, we had cul-de-sacs, so we would have kids running up and down the street, and it didn't matter how old everybody was dressed up. And then you had the parents, the ones that were actually chaperoning, that would wait at the end of either like on the sidewalk and send you up into the house, or not into the house, but up to the door, or you were with a whole bunch of friends, or in some cases we would have people that would drive over in a van, and they would have like all the kids in the van, and they'd be like, okay, everybody get out. And then they'd scatter and they trick or treat, and then they jump back in the van and go to another like part of town. And I remember being in my early teens that I was still the person that wanted to go out and dress up. Yeah, I had a little brother, and he was like, whatever, I'm too cool for this. And I was like, shut up, you're getting free candy and you get to dress up. And it felt...
Shout out to Amy's little brother who actually listens to the show.
Yeah, I mean, he's like, whatever, it's cool. But he was like, no, I don't want to do this no more. And he's always been a lot cooler than me, so I can appreciate that. But when it came to this, it always felt like for Halloween that it was something sacred. Mm. Like watching first and last Halloweens and unexpected losses of innocence too when it comes to it, because you see like those moms and dads who have like the babies or the toddlers, and it's the first one and they're learning how to say trick or treat, or the ones that trick or treat and they can't say, you know, trick or treat. And it gives you the sense of community and kind of kindness, but also that you're given an opportunity to see how other people celebrate. And then when you get to the very, very end of it, where you have those teenagers, which, like, dang, you meddling kids, old timers are like, if you're over the age of 12, you shouldn't be trick-or-treating. I beg to differ. For every kid that's literally shown up and trick-or-treated, as long as they're dressed up and they have good manners, I'll give you candy. Like, there's no question about it, because there's so many other things you could be doing.
Mm.
And it speaks such volumes to me that you're still going, someone's willing to give me free candy if I just dress up and I'm polite. Yeah. And I'm like, I love that. There was an anecdote that somebody had put out on the internet the other day that I read, and it was a mom who said she had opened the door and there was standing literally like a 6-foot-tall Freddy and a 6-foot-tall Jason. And they're standing there and they said, trick or treat. And she looked at them and they parted. And right in the middle was their little sister. And she was like 6 or 7 and she was dressed up as a princess. And I was like, that's it. That's the community part of Halloween that I appreciate. And if we want to talk horror movies, trick or treat at the beginning before everything goes, you know, Sam up, really, really kind of reminds me of some of the childhood that I got to experience. So, yeah, that's why I like it.
Yeah, which is something to say, because you don't usually just, why do I have to be scary? But I'm glad because you like trick or treat.
You like scary things. That's
not all. Okay. We're not going to get into this because we don't have enough time, but there have been recommendations that I've given you that you were like, no, it's scary. And then you watch it and like, oh my gosh, that was a really great movie. And it's like, come on.
It can still be scary and I still don't have to like it.
But it can also be scary and you can actually really like it.
I can also appreciate all the hard work and
dedication. So anyway, speaking of scary movies, we are going to transition over into our main conversation of the evening as we wrap up this month of horror, cosmic horror-tastic. We're not throwing precious starches around, okay?
That's the Earth's apple. That is wonderful.
In fact, I find it so hilarious that there are people who are handing out potatoes now for trick or for Halloween.
That's an entirely different conversation. Yeah, we're not doing that.
But
we're not giving out ramen or potatoes.
This does bring us to our conversation as we cap off the cosmic horror-tastic month of October with our review of 1995's In the Mouth of Madness. This is one of John Carpenter's films and one of his lesser known but still amazingly wonderful films. And we're excited to dig in. So before we move any further, Spencer, why don't you give us that official synopsis goodness?
Sutter Kane is the best-selling author whose newest novel is literally driving readers insane. When he inexplicably vanishes, his publisher sends special investigator John Trent to track him down. Drawn to the town that only exists in Kane's books, Trent crosses the barrier between fact and fiction and enters a terrifying world from which there is no escape.
Directed and scored by the one and only John Carpenter and written by Michael DeLuca, the film stars Sam Neill, Julie Carmen, Jürgen Prochnow, David Warner, and Charlton Heston. A couple key pieces about the film. In the film, the works of Sutter Kane are occasionally quoted. Most, if not all, of these quotes are actually taken directly from several H.P. Lovecraft short stories, with some adaptations to fit them into the film's story. Most notably, in the scenes where Stiles reads to Trent as he gazes into the abyss, her speech lifts much of its description, including such elements as the illimitable gulf of the unknown from the last few paragraphs of Lovecraft's The Rats in the Walls. In an earlier scene as well, Trent reads a line verbatim from Lovecraft's The Haunter of the Dark, in reference to the Black Church being, quote, the seat of an evil older than mankind and wider than the known universe, end quote. Which is really great, because it's obviously like a proxy. He's obviously the proxy for H.P. Lovecraft in a modern time. And again, we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of this movie, but it makes sense that they lifted quotes directly from H.P. Lovecraft's work, so. Another key piece of information, this is actually the third film in what John Carpenter has called his Apocalypse Trilogy, the first being 1982's The Thing, and the second being 1987's Prince of Darkness, which Prince of Darkness also stars Sam Neill in it as well. So that's really great. I forget his name, but let's see, Prince of Darkness.
Not the guy that played Sutter Kane, right?
No. Donald Pleasance. Donald Pleasance, who, if you remember from John Carpenter's previous work in Halloween, plays Dr. Loomis. He plays the priest in Prince of Darkness. So it's interesting. You have Donald Pleasance from Halloween and then transitions over into this, where you have in Prince of Darkness, you have Sam Neill as well. And then it transitions over with to this movie In the Mouth of Madness. So really great stuff, really fun. And then last but not least, and this is something that Amy had to point out during the film, and so we had to actually make it a point to actually mention in our notes.
I earned it.
This is Hayden Christensen's feature film debut. Woo! As he's the paperboy that Trent meets on the road.
Yeah. So. We
absolutely
see you.
Absolutely crazy.
The fact that I was like, he just gave this side eye and I was like, Aiden, is that you? I see you.
So obviously this movie has been out for what, 30 years now? 30 years. So obviously no holds on spoilers. Spoiler alert. You have been warned. So let's talk about this movie. Obviously, as Spencer mentioned, this is a very unique film coming from John Carpenter, and a very much celebrated one for those who have seen it. And for those who haven't, you're missing out. So, but let's start with expectations. Now, I really kind of want to lean towards Amy first, because I don't think she had any idea what this movie was about at all.
Heck no, techno. if you haven't already heard from previous ones, I was not excited. Still, I'm like, can we get done with this month, please?
Never.
Especially because In the Mouth of Madness reminded me of At the Mountains of Madness, which is an H.P. Lovecraft story. Everybody goes crazy, everybody dies, you know, just maddening stuff. And also coming off of Event Horizon, as soon as you said Sam Neill, I was like, no, not again. Sam Neill, why? So my expectations were, God, I hope it is short and swift, unlike this month.
Okay. that's one way to put it. Spencer, what were some of your expectations?
Okay. So,
because actually, not to interrupt you, but because you actually made it a point to mention to me, whatever we do this month, we need to make sure we do this movie because I've already invested too much into it.
Yeah, because we were talking about sorting things, and like I was like, I can't lose this movie because when we were talking about that, I had already bought or was planning on buying the 4K Blu-ray for the movie. Yes. So I was like, we can't lose it now.
He's like, I'm in too deep. I can't.
Yeah. So I was like, plus that's kind of a different thing for me to buy a movie sight unseen before.
Yeah.
So I was like, it's kind of good. It's only because YouTube had shown me a like brief trailer and I was like turning it off. I was like, no, I think I've seen enough. I'm sold on this movie already. So I was very excited going into this movie to just see what was going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. This has always been, so I remember seeing this way back when, and I think I want to say I actually watched it on a streaming platform. It might've been on Amazon, but I've seen it maybe twice in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. And it always is like, every time I see it, it's always this new feeling of watching it because it takes so long for me to rewatch it. I have to say there's probably a minimum of like less than, has to be, maybe like 5 to 7 years in between each viewing. Mm-hmm. So it's been, because I believe the last time I saw this was like back in like 2016, 2017. So it's been a while. And then before that, obviously, it was probably around like maybe Blockbuster time, Hollywood Video time framing. So, yeah, like it had been a while. So I was like, man, I really want to see a trailer, but I know if I see a trailer, everything's going to flood back. And I don't really want to do that because I kind of want to experience this fresh. But I was excited. I know that when it comes to people like John Carpenter, people like Sam Neill, what are you giggling about over there?
Sorry, there's a part very close to the beginning of the film, but it's, oh no, not the Carpenters. Sorry.
Okay. That 70s music. You gotta right. Aware of that. Just begun.
But you have people like Sam Neill in this. You had a role for Charlton Heston. Like everything about this movie just screamed, what is this going to be about? Because it's like random folks in a movie. And so I was excited. I really do enjoy John Carpenter's work. I had actually just seen in one of our local art theaters, I had just seen a 35mm print or 70mm print of The Thing. So that was actually really cool. I got a chance to see that for my birthday. So yeah, I was already one third of the way and watching this, I was already two thirds of the way going through the Apocalypse trilogy. So, yeah, but moving forward, let's talk about first impressions. So actually, as Spencer stated, he got the 4K Blu-ray in, and we actually saw it, over at his house. On his massive TV. He's got this huge, like, 75-inch TV.
It's like 65.
Whatever. It's one of those OLED.
It's not that yes. big.
It's an OLED nice. TV with a 4K Blu-ray of this movie. And let me just say, that was an experience to behold. So that was great. So we saw the film. First impressions right outside the gate. Let's start with Amy, because I feel she's going to have either the most to say or the least to say.
What if I'm in the middle and just say some?
You'll still probably have a point to make.
Yeah, I always have a point to make. It's me. So first impressions right out to the gate. This wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. Yay.
Okay. Like I said, the least to say. Spencer, what about
I'm
you?
First space.
Okay. So basically after this movie finished, I started asking you questions. Mm-hmm. I was like, isn't there a movie similar to this movie?
Oh, yeah.
And I was really like racking my brain. I'm like, what in the world am I thinking of? And I finally figured it out.
What was it?
I was thinking of this movie. I've seen it before. but here's the thing. I didn't get that vibe until like near the end of the movie.
Uh-huh.
And so here's what I am guessing happened. I think as a child, I was just surfing through the TV.
Uh-huh.
And I think I saw Sam Neill and had already seen Jurassic Park at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And I stopped and got drawn into the later half of the movie. It was like, I think it was right before the lady disappeared because like, I was like, she just seems so out of place because like, I think I just saw everything after that. Because the rest of the movie, like, especially once like we're back in the insane asylum and no one's there, super familiar. It just all felt super familiar. So I think I've seen the ending of this movie before. I didn't realize it until I saw it all the
Hey, repressed memories don't always have to be a bad thing, right? That's actually really cool. It's funny because I think I've only been that particular person in a lot of these situations, in these conversations. So I was like, oh yeah, I did see this. But I realize it a lot sooner. Before getting to like that certain point in the movie and just like, oh yeah, I did see this. It was, again, that infamous Fox Saturday afternoon movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All those Saturday afternoon movies, they like crawl into our heads somehow.
Seriously, Fox has made most of our childhoods with those movies. So
yeah.
As far as myself, like I love this movie. I love John Carpenter. I love where his brain works, where he's just like, I'm going to make something scary about the end of the world. But I'm going to make fun of things too. I'm going to have fun. And it's like, you don't get that from really anyone else. And that's just kind of the way he operates. He's just like, he's very brash and very like up in your face. But at the same time, he can make the most scariest things. I mean, like you take a look at like The Shape from the first Halloween movie, Michael Myers. And it's like at the time that was monstrous. That was scary. The boogeyman. He's literally the boogeyman. But then at the same time, you have things like Big Trouble in Little China. You know, you have those types of things. Like, it's like, come on. Or Escape from New York. Like, that's John Carpenter as well. These types of movies are fun and ridiculous. And like, what is he thinking? And then he comes to a point where he's like, all right, I've done slasher. I've done, you know, action. I've done let me do a cosmic horror movie. Let me do an H.P. Lovecraft adaptation kind of thing. And he's just like, yeah, let's have fun with it. So let's kind of move forward into cast of this movie, because honestly, I feel like we really have like followed the train of thought with this month in our first movie, which was Out the Color of Space or In the Color
Color
Out of Space.
Yes.
We had a particular actress named Jolie Richardson, mm-hmm. who then is connected to the next movie we saw because she was one of the cast members in Event Horizon.
And she lives. First time she died. Next one she lives.
And then we had Sam Neill in Event Horizon as well. And then
question mark lives?
I'm pretty sure he's probably out there somewhere. Mm. And then we get this film, which stars Sam Neill as well in this one. And so
who lives?
Yeah.
Ish.
Ish.
For now.
The way you have for now.
But I think there's not really much else to say about Sam Neill that we didn't say last time.
Mm. No, I have new things to say about Sam Neill.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Yay. Okay. So
did she say yay or gay?
Yay.
Okay, just making sure. She's like gay. Like
No. Well, happy wise. Okay, so,
so sure.
First off, it was nice to hear Sam Neill be allowed to use almost his real accent in some cases. It felt like he was trying to just be normal and he forgot because he was around other people, which I always like just hearing him speak regularly. And then when it came down to it, there were moments in this that there was this wide-eyed kind of like, I'm not crazy. Like, I found it after seeing him in Event Horizon where he was like, not evil Mr. Burns, but it was like, and I'm like here to ruin everything. There was a sinister nature to him in that film, where in here it's like he's the Doubting Thomas. He's consistently the Doubting Thomas. But when we first see him, because this film is done mostly is told in flashback, he has this just like, like, you can't see my face, but his eyes are really, really wide. And it gave a kind of sense of staunch denial / like bridging into that space between he could be crazy, but you can't tell. And I liked it so much. And again, Eddie made fun of me because like, this is the only thing you've ever seen Sam Neill in has been Jurassic Park. And I was like, an Event Horizon. And I didn't like him in that. And I've also seen Hunt for the Wilder People, which is fantastic. So yeah, I had a really great time seeing another side of Sam Neill where I was like, okay, I actually really like this. This is cool.
Yeah.
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 I think the biggest thing when it comes to like Sam Neill in this one, like it looks like, because you recognize and again, we stated this last week, you recognize that if most people look at Sam Neill, they probably look at him in this form of like this protagonist approach. He's always either the hero, he works with the hero, he is on the side of good. Mostly because, and we can honestly blame Jurassic Park.
He's on the side of dinosaurs.
You know, so...
Except that third one.
He was on the side of dinosaurs, he just wasn't on the side of getting eaten by him. I think coming to this opportunity, and I call it an opportunity, to see Sam Neill in a light that pits him more as the antagonist, or even the fraying sanity of what happens to a good man in a bad atmosphere or in a bad reality, if we want to use in this particular aspect. It's daunting. It's like really impressive because we're not used to seeing Sam Neill not be in charge or not be in control. We're not used to seeing Sam Neill not be the fixed point of resolution. And he is quite literally the bringer of the apocalypse.
Unintentionally.
Like, yeah. And so, or intentionally, subconsciously, who knows? I find that so refreshing because, again, Sam Neill has played mostly protagonists throughout most of his career. And to get a chance to see where Sam Neill doesn't have all the answers or he's not, you know, Dr. Grant's going to save us. Like, no, this is not Dr. Grant. This is, you know, this is very much the lawyer watching the T-Rex come down and chomp him. Like, this is somebody who sees the impending doom and can only do so much to delay the inevitable, you know? And I love this for him. I love the opportunity of seeing Sam Neill lose his mind on set. And it was great. It was really wonderful because, like I said, playing against typecast, this could have only been directed and led by somebody as great as John Carpenter. Mm. So, was there anybody else you guys wanted to highlight?
Oh my gosh, I can't remember his name, but the guy that I saw at the beginning and I was like, look.
Oh, John Glover.
Yeah. And I'm like, look, it's young Lionel Luther.
Oh, what is he like, a nurse tech or something?
I think he's like one of the doctors for the insane asylum. We see him so briefly, but I always get a slight like, yay, because my first, and this sounds really ridiculous, the first time I actually saw him in something was Smallville, go figure. Yeah. And then I saw him in Gremlins too.
Wait, hold on.
I said what I said.
Okay.
I said what I said. You just heard it. You heard it, dear listeners.
I'm just making sure I heard it right.
You did. Okay. I saw him first in Smallville, then I saw him in Gremlins 2, and then I saw him in this. And I was like, oh, he just keeps getting younger.
So no, you also saw him in Shazam.
Oh, shoot.
Did you forget? Scrooged before?
I've never seen Scrooged.
Ah.
Spencer.
Yeah.
I still haven't.
That's okay.
Was it the one with Bobcat?
Bill Murray and Bobcat Goldthwait. Yeah, you have
seen it. I have seen that one. Okay, that happened to the last year.
Okay.
But for a minute, I was like, no, I haven't seen that. And then I was like, wait, Bobcat's in that one.
Yeah.
I like Bobcat.
Okay.
But yeah, John Glover. Yeah. So I'm just like, oh, he's getting younger. And it was just kind of.
He's getting younger. Okay.
In the way that I'm watching it, he keeps getting younger. It was fun. It was a very small part. However, he also was just very like, it was very delightful. It even in the way that he was tinted and how he portrayed it was like, everybody else is crazy in here, but I'm just cheerful. And I'm like, that can be a form of insanity, sir. I am aware of this personally, but yeah. So yay, John Glover.
Yay, John Glover.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I was gonna shout out Julie Carmen, who played Linda Stiles.
Okay.
Linda had a journey. But like you could just see her like being like, you know, I'm not into this lawyer hitting on me constantly. And then slowly like going down the road of like, things are happening and I don't know what to do about it, Plus, I'm driving in the sky now. How is that possible? Like, a whole plethora of things happened. And by the end, she's like, yeah, I'm done here. I saw the end. Bye.
And she
just left the movie. I was like, okay. Like, just a very interesting character and really great portrayal. I liked what she did.
Mm-hmm. Quick note, I'm surprised you guys didn't mention David Warner. I don't know if you guys follow the podcast, but he plays the narrator and the doctor in the Doctor Who podcast series. Mm-hmm. Like for years. We're talking since 1999. He has played a voice or the doctor himself, either the narrator, a role, or the doctor himself in the podcast series. Mm-hmm. In fact, there was even a recent one right before his passing called Dark Gallifrey, where he played the doctor in that one. So
that's my bad. I have another person that I wanted to shout out really fast.
But before I go on, I did want to mention one more person since we're going around. Jürgen Prochnow.
Sutter Kane.
Yeah, he's the one who plays Sutter Kane.
Great head of hair.
But he always plays bad guys. And oddly enough, this is the first time where I'm like, okay, he's not really the bad guy. He's just
the guy
who happens to be standing in front of the bad guys. So he's usually attributed to the bad guys. But he usually plays like a bad guy. He played Judge Dredd. In Judge Dredd, he was one of the bad judges, Judge Griffin, who pretty much sets up Judge Dredd to take the fall. He was in Beer Fest. He plays the mean grandfather who doesn't want anything to do with his illegitimate family members. I'm so used to seeing him in those roles. He was, although he was in 1984's Dune.
Who is he?
He was the father. He was Leto.
No.
Yeah.
Dang. I guess I gotta go watch that again. I'm in it for the battle pug.
And mind you, he's not in this movie a lot, but for his role that he's there, he plays a really good, like, H.P. Lovecraft proxy, I would feel. Like, someone who's seen the impending demise of the universe and is like, yeah, well, hey, it's going to happen. Here you go. Just take it back to your people because I got to go and see, the bad things.
I mean, that's about right. At first, when you kind of see him, like when they do the swinging doors, the church thing, and you see him and he's like, haha, I'm spooky, Willy Wonka. Like, he's
spooky Willy Wonka.
His vibe and his look is so cheeky. And you're like, you're the bad guy? Are you sure? And then it's like he disappears. And the next time we see him, he's sitting at a typewriter. And you're like, sir, what is happening?
Yeah.
What is happening?
I got to give a shout out to him. I think he's really great. I think he's a great actor. And I feel like he's gotten better with age. I don't know if he's still,
he should still be around. I think he's like in his 80s.
Okay. Yeah. Born 1941.
Dang.
However, the particular actor I did mention, David Warner, he did pass away in 2022. So his voice was used for those latter works. But also David Warner. I mean, Spencer, I don't know if you remember him from Star Trek VI. He's the Chancellor in Undiscovered Country.
The Klingon one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, dear. That's more of a knock against how the Klingons were portrayed. Nothing about that, man. It's very different.
Amy, you were going to mention one more person before we got to move on?
Yes. I want to give a shout out to the late, great Frances Bay, a.k.a. she played Mrs. Pickman. But when she came on screen, I went, oh, it's Happy Gilmore's grandma. She has been around. She has been literally the Mrs. in so many things. So she always seemed to have played those parts.
Mm-hmm.
But in this, she is just the turn with her, too, that you just. Yeah, there's a sequence and she starts out just fine. And then you get to the second part of the sequence before she has her big turn. And you're just like, ma'am, ma'am, what are you doing?
Even before she had her big turn, she looked awful.
Yeah.
I was like, what is happening?
Like, she looked like she was, they darkened her eyes, mm-hmm. but it looked like she was on something. She was like, do I know her? No. Okay. Well, whatever. Like it just seemed like she was so, she almost seemed like a teenager, you know, in her like, yeah, it was great seeing her in this one.
But yeah, just Frances is absolutely like, I get excited whenever I see her in anything because it's not like, oh, she was born to play a grandma. It's the fact that she just makes me smile every time I see her. And even in this, I was like, oh, oh, then we watched the behind the scenes and I was like, oh, oh, no. Okay, Frances, you're still good. I like you.
Moving into the story element, like obviously this story is unique to kind of what you would expect out of H.P. Lovecraft. You know, you have this, again, impending doom, this impending, you know, looming threat that is over everybody that you don't know exactly what it is, but people are mad searching for an answer, some type of reasoning behind it. This one happens to be cloaked around the search for a lost author. And
not the lost author, the story.
Well, yeah.
Charlton Heston was very clear about his demands. If you find the author, great. He still owes us stuff. If you don't find the author, like he's deceased, he still owes us stuff. Give us our stuff. And I'm like, sir, what?
Yeah, it was. And Charlton Heston is another one to know. Like he has a very short role in this, but it's good to see him in movies and see him pop back up every now and then. Yeah, and this movie just right from the get-go takes you to like crazy town really quick. Even the beginning, which Amy had mentioned, this movie does work through recollections and remembering and recounting of events. Starts out pretty abrupt, where you have a wild Sam Neill entering into an insane asylum and is retelling the accounts as to how he got there. Mm-hmm. And so the overall story itself does play fast and loose with like as far as where at what point in time everything goes and what's happening. And then you get to a point to where time ultimately has no meaning in the movie. Mm-hmm. Like it doesn't matter how much time has passed or how much time you think has passed because you don't know how much time has passed. It'll tell you how much time has passed. And yeah, it turns into this massive like goose chase for this author who is the product of the author in this effort to bring back their cash cow, if you will, and bring about ultimately the demise and the apocalypse of the world that we live in. Yeah, this movie was really fun. And this absolutely, the story, like elements of it, the way it drove, I don't really feel like there was any part where I felt bored.
No.
And I feel like that's a really, really strong thing to say about an H.P. Lovecraft type story, like a cosmic horror. Because we go back to the first one we'd reviewed this month, The Color Out of Space or Color Out of Space. And there were points where like, okay, you know, this is kind of droning, but all right, you know, we're good. We're working through things. This didn't have any of those moments. Like every moment in this movie seemed important, valuable. It seemed meaningful. And I didn't feel at any point in time where I was like, this could be cut out or that could be cut out. Like, I don't know. What do you think, Spence?
I don't think you could really cut anything out of this movie.
Yeah.
Because I feel like it was just, this is such a tight story and they did such a great job of just making sure the movie is always driving somewhere. Because I feel like even the driving scene where they're just driving down this thing, like they're constantly adding things in there to where you're like, why are we repeatedly passing this old person? Why is the car in the sky? That one's really the one that got me.
Yeah.
But I felt like the pacing of the movie was great. And I feel like they just did a fantastic job on just having like a driving force that, you know, I feel like a lot of movies nowadays don't quite have, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think, Ames?
I totally agree. This felt like there was, it went a lot quicker than I expected. It didn't have any spots where there was lag. And even as much as I was like, there could be places to expound, it really couldn't. Like, yeah, if we went and, you know, turned a corner and really extended it, we could end up with more kind of more rabbit trails in particular things like the old man slash question mark on the bicycle, or anybody else in the town, like the one random little girl or the guy that's trying to save his kids, or like there's opportunities because my brain's like, well, what about that guy? Well, what about that guy? But it carried so much speed in driving towards its destination that I was still engaged. And even though people made fun of me about jumping, I was still engaged.
Well, you were being antagonized while you were watching.
A little bit.
Once. It was only one time.
It was twice.
But then also I was jumping anyway. So I was like, I expected some of that.
But you know, another thing is that like, while the movie is not slow, it's also not fast too.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Because like some movies will just be like, and we're going real fast. And I'm like, wait, hold on. How is this connected to that? This movie didn't really have that problem either. Like,
yeah.
Its pacing is quite perfect, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Because it's funny you mentioned that, like, as far as like, because this only has an hour 35 runtime,
mm-hmm.
which is, again, for the mid 90s, early 90s, late 80s, that's typical. I mean, that's mm-hmm. what you would come to expect. Like, you would expect an hour and a half runtime. Nowadays, two and a half hours seems the norm for most of these movies nowadays, which is fine. It's just what we've accustomed ourselves to. But for an hour and a half, it didn't feel rushed. It felt like it was evenly spaced. I was watching a movie earlier today. I was watching 1992's, I think. Let me double check. Yeah, 1992's Leprechaun with Warwick Davis, Jennifer Aniston. Yeah. And I was watching it, and it was weird because you were mentioning, I don't think that's a very long movie either. That is a hour 32.
Yeah.
But that particular movie, there's a scene where Jennifer Aniston calls the sheriff. So a lot of things are happening. He ends up, like, the leprechaun ends up chasing down a cop, and he ends up killing. Yeah. And he ends up catching up with him in a forest, and he kills him in the forest. Like, he literally uses his legs, the leprechaun, and breaks his neck. Leaves him in the forest, right? And then goes back and attacks Jennifer Aniston and everyone, blah, blah, blah. Where's me gold? You know, all that kind of stuff. And then we get a point where Jennifer Aniston and the rest of the group are inside the house, and she tries to get a hold of the sheriff. She gets a hold of him, but her battery dies on her phone. And the sheriff calls down through his radio to an officer that's supposedly in the area. And he's like, hey, can you go check out the old Grady farm? Sounds like a whatever, this, that, I need you. And he responds, he's like, 10-4, sheriff, I'll be whatever. And then he goes back to the scene where he's talking. It's actually the leprechaun mimicking his voice. And I'm like, when the heck did that, when did the leprechaun get to the car? And not only that, but the dead body of the officer was in the passenger seat. And I'm like, how did he get the body of the guy in there? And I had to look online, and I looked online and was like, oh, because there was a deleted scene where he ends up putting the body back in there, and he's eating the officer's donuts. And there's an in-between scene.
Donuts are very important to the story this.
Apparently. So I'm like, well, I mean, that little bit of information would have probably helped me understand, like, why is he back in the car? Where is that car located? Is it close to the farm? You know, then it would make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And in this case, like, even though it was an hour 35, there wasn't any scene that occurred in this movie where I was like, hold up, wait, how did we get here? Wait, why is this like that? This doesn't make sense. It feels like something's missing. Like, there was never a moment like that.
Yeah,
it was very evenly spaced. It was very timely, and it was very well done.
Yeah, even in the space where it's the repeat, you're trying to leave the town and you keep showing up in the same spot, that didn't feel like you're like, oh my gosh, again. It was like, oh, nope, it still hasn't sunk in. And you didn't need to increase the amount of times that it happened or decrease it, because it was right in that pocket where it was more, we got it, he can't leave the town. But it was more in the case of Sam Neill's character realizing, like, how many times did he need to, like, actually do this to realize, oh, I can't leave. Like, there's something about having those repeats where, you know, it's too much. And I don't even know if it was the rule of threes, like, the third time, you know, by the third time you should get it. It just felt like it was right for his character. Because we're like, no, we get it. You can't go anywhere. And he's like, no, I can try again, I swear. And you're not like, well, okay, dum-dum, it's gonna suck for you. We're like, no, yeah, nope. Yeah, you still don't believe, right? Okay.
Yeah. Oh, it sounded like you were gonna say something.
Nope.
You're just like leprechaun and donuts.
Leprechaun and donuts. And I, again, that goes back to like the genius behind, you know, John Carpenter and his work, especially with the score. Like this movie's score felt ethereal. It felt spooky at times, but it still felt like it was never like at the forefront of the scenes, but it definitely built the scene. Like it was an actual character all on its own. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I love that because like John Carpenter, ever since I guess with The Thing, has just been like, you know what? I'm not going to pay anybody to do it. I can do it real quickly. And he does it on his own.
Yeah, usually that doesn't work out super well for most people, but it works out really well for John Carpenter.
Yeah, which was actually interesting because I think I read it on the wiki that he had wanted the opening number. Yeah, he wanted to have the main title or the main theme be Enter Sandman from Metallica. Mm. But he couldn't get the rights to it. So he's like, I'll write something else. I got it. And I was like, mm-hmm.
That makes a lot of sense because that was the vibe I was getting from the opening sequence. Like, obviously, younger, I didn't really recognize it. But like now that I'm at that age where I'm like, oh, yeah, that opening feels very Metallica. Mm-hmm. And if he wrote that, which obviously he did, then it makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense. But yeah, you take somebody like John Carpenter who incredibly recognizes the importance of a solid soundtrack, not as to be like the star of the film, but to be a part of the ensemble cast, as important as its lead roles. You have somebody who recognizes why music is what, like the soundtrack is what makes a movie a horror movie. Because quite literally, you could remove all the horror music out of every single scary movie and put in that, you know, or put something ridiculous in there, and it would be a comedy. It would absolutely be silly. And nobody would take it for the horror aspect it really is or what it's intended. And John Carpenter recognizes that. He is such a genius when it comes to that. And again, that just echoes everything he's done in previous films, especially going back to the original, you know, horror film of his career, and that is one of the original ones, and that is, you know, Halloween, where just creating that whole and then like the stinger
is like, I cannot now, especially after having seen Halloween, I just even hearing that stinger, I'm like, oh god, no, don't play this in the dark, nope, I gotta go. And I think that really has such a great note to what John Carpenter can not only produce, but what he can create that transcends generations now, that he is so firmly imprinted in the zeitgeist of not just horror, but in pop culture, that this is like, it's his legacy and it's a good one.
Yeah.
What do you guys feel when it comes to movies like, so obviously we've been discussing cosmic horror all month. What is it that you guys have taken away? Because I feel like I can earnestly say I don't think you guys have, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't believe you guys have seen as many cosmic horror films in a given situation like we've done this month.
Nope.
Mm-mm. No. What would you say is like the biggest takeaway regarding cosmic horror films and kind of the space where, like, what is it that someone would absolutely need to have within their film if they were going to make a cosmic horror film, just based on the information and the experience you guys have had thus far?
Well, okay. I feel like the theme of the month has been basically some other entity is a kid with a magnifying glass burning ants, and we are the ants.
100%.
Like, I feel like if you're trying to make a cosmic horror movie, it must have that vibe in it, because like that's like what the movies we reviewed have definitely had. That like you are just playthings to something else and there's nothing you're gonna do about it.
Yeah, I think that actually sums it up really perfectly, Spence. When it comes down to it, the overwhelming nature of there is something bigger than us and they do not care And then the realization that they don't care and there's no begging, pleading, bargaining. There's nothing you can do to make the outcome be anything but death is so like it's a stark realization where I'm like, no wonder people went mad. The existential crisis of I no longer matter when we've told each other like we matter. We're the biggest thing on the food, like on the top of the food chain. And then something's like, nope. And nope. Really, when it comes to the cosmic core that we've seen, it has been encompassing that. And it's one of those things that I don't want to dwell on because I don't want to go nuts either. I'd prefer just to like, okay. I know that when we get into that scope of much like in this film, Sutter Kane's like, listen, I saw the end. I gotta go. It's happening anyway. And then Linda's she's like, I saw the end. I have to stay. This is how it goes. Like there's no way to save you. And then the ones that's like, no, I can still save people. And we're like, that the unwavering hope. Or yeah, it's almost a stubborn hope that you can make a difference and it will be okay, mm-hmm. which is a hallmark of humanity in the face of overwhelming insanity, is such an interesting thing to kind of see, which we saw in, help me, Event Horizon with Jolie's character and in the color Out of Space, we saw it with his first name is Elliot, but I cannot remember the rest of his name. The guy that's our water scientist.
Oh,
like
yes.
he has that too. And so we have somebody. And then in this, it really is John Trent Sam Neill, that is like, no, I'm telling you, this is what it is. And it's like, it's just interesting. So we need the entity with the magnifying glass to our ants. And we need one ant that's like, I can save you guys. Listen to me. And then at the end, he's like, well, that didn't work.
I feel like there's a lot of, and it's funny that you mentioned as far as like not getting into that reality or going mad on your own.
I was already crazy. That's okay. I don't need any more else.
But I think that's the joy, I guess, if you want to look at it from that perspective of, you know, building something as unique as a cosmic horror piece, recognizing like your depths are only as deep as your, I guess, mental,
your capacity.
I was gonna say your capacity to understand your mental, you know, depravity or humanity's like depravity. Like it's ultimately sky's the limit, but it also shines a light on the creator itself. Mm-hmm. In so many words, like you recognize, like if someone is building something or someone is creating something with such a sense of grotesque or unnatural truth or a sense of foreboding, you know, nature that aligns itself a little too closely to reality or too closely to truth, where is that person at within their life? You know, there's a reason why like certain people, certain artists, whether if they're performers, directors, writers, there's a reason why like some of those people, when they get too close in particular roles or things like that, they tend to need to take a step back after it's done and completely like purge from that role. Who was it? There was a performer who, Skarsgård, Bill Skarsgård
from It.
Yeah. No, well, yeah, from It, but anyway. Specifically from Nosferatu. Oh, when he wrote, he said he never wants to do a character that evil again because it took a lot out of him. Hmm. And because he was so immersed in it, he was so like fluent in it. He made it. Bill Skarsgård is a very, I would say he's pretty close as method as can be, you know, without actually being like either a killer clown killing little kids or whatever, or, you know, being a vampire, so to speak.
Or a clown that sends rats to his coworkers.
Yes. Yeah. Jared Leto. dead rats at that.
Yes.
But I remember him talking in an interview how he said like he won't be able to do something like that again because it took so much out of him. He had to step away from that for a little bit just to, you know, kind of, you know, get back to baseline. And you have to wonder, like, and it kind of goes in this particular season, it kind of goes to the mentality of like those, the candles that burn the brightest, you know, that whole adage. Like you think of people like Edgar Allan Poe, you think of H.P. Lovecraft, you think of a lot of these particular individuals, you know, and even more so in the modern era, people who pour themselves into that aspect of the world. Like, what are the things that they use, or what are the things that they have to go through to get to those spaces?
Well, Heath Ledger is the perfect example of that.
Not to say that that's what did it to him.
No.
But to say that...
But the extent of pouring yourself into a character to embody it fully, and not only struggling to come up for air, but being able to recognize yourself. I think Daniel Day-Lewis also is one of those actors who pours himself into the roles that he does, where he has to take extended.
Oh, he's complete method. Like he is absolutely the definition of method acting. I mean, for God's sakes, in The Gangs of New York, he actually went to go work at a butcher shop for weeks on end just to prepare for the persona of the character that he was going to play in The Gangs of New York, which is phenomenal. He actually took up lessons in being a tailor for, what is that movie, the last one he did? The Phantom Thread, which was a phenomenal film as well. It was spellbinding. Him and Kate Winslet, phenomenal in that movie. When people in the industry talk about method acting, the first name that people come up with is Daniel Day-Lewis. Mm-hmm. Second name is Heath Ledger because of his, you know, so much like the immersion that he had with his character role. There was someone else that they were talking about that was absolutely... Oh, Jim Carrey is another one, honestly. Mm-hmm. Jim Carrey is one of those people who, I mean, for God's sakes, the movie The Man on the Moon is about as method as can be for anybody. And the fact that they captured it on film, all the behind the scenes stuff, and they showed it, and it's like Jim Carrey is quite literally acting as though he is Andy Kaufman. It is a journey unto itself to watch something like that and see like what truth means behind the eyes of these particular performers. It's profound. And I'm glad things like that exist to see kind of the again, not to use a phrase twice, but you know, to get a peek behind the curtain, so to speak. So did you guys have any issues or highlights that you guys wanted to bring up? And I want to start with Amy because she's got her both hands raised.
Highlight.
Okay, she's got a highlight. I was worried about this highlight. For a second.
Because I have a deep and abiding affection for creators, ILM, Industrial Light and Magic, actually were the people that did all the puppetry work in this, including one of the things that we got to watch in the behind the scenes, because Spencer had behind the scenes on his cool guy player for this, where we saw the 18-foot wall of unspeakable abomination creatures, which you can't even really see all the way, which is amazing.
which is by far one of the most creative things I've ever seen John Carpenter do, because if I would have saw that entire wall, I probably would have laughed right away. Like, what the heck is that?
Well, turns out this 18-foot wall, not only did ILM create it, it took 25 people to move it and to do all the different moving parts and everything. It's on rollers, which I think was the best part, that I was like, it's rolling. And then when we were watching the behind the scenes, when you heard people yelling out the people's names that were like doing different things and were in different portions of the costume and in other costumes, I was just like, this is fantastic. From a pure delight sense, that was really great for me. But also because, again, I have begrudgingly, it's less begrudging now. I don't know. Is there mid-grudging? I don't know. Like,
what's trying to mid-grudge now?
I don't know. I'm not like full begrudge. I'm in the space of like, no, I can see the point.
So you're a little grudge.
Little grudge.
You're the grudge.
I don't want to be the grudge. That's a problem. I haven't seen that one either. Spencer, no.
Oh, no.
No. So practical effects in this movie, there are just moments that I'm like, yes, yes, yes. And I think it is just another showing and love letter to John Carpenter. And I'm going to back off because I know both of you can talk in extents about those things. Yeah.
Actually, yeah, that was going to be my highlight as well. It was like just practical effect work.
The scene with the monster wall, though, that did, like, once I saw the special effects, I was like, oh, I really do appreciate exceedingly good editing. Because, yes. like, the way that this was shot and, like, edited, it looks wildly scarier than, like, actually just flat out seeing it.
Steve.
Yeah.
Steve, speed up.
Steve, speed up. Slow down. Like, honestly, buy physical media, people. You'll get loads of extras with it, and it's totally worth it. But another one from practical effects is, what's the actress name that you were talking about who had that?
Frances Bay.
Yes, they had a puppet of her when she turned into a monster later.
I was wondering who's going to bring that up.
Yes, yeah. And I was like, this is fantastic. Yes. Like, yes, it looks fake, but it looks great though.
Yes, it does. And yeah. It has her face on it. And then there's the puppeteers too, where they're like, wiggle the tentacles more. And I loved being able to see that, but also that it looked like her. Yeah. It wasn't just like some unnamed, ooh, ooga booga booga. That was fantastic.
Yeah.
I would have to say, like, honestly, I've already spoken at length about the soundtrack, and I think the soundtrack was phenomenal. But I have to say, one of my biggest highlights going back to performances was seeing Sam Neill play again against typecast. We saw it in his performance in Event Horizons, and it was great. Like, we saw this slow progression and whatnot, but it was very much what?
I didn't think it was slow, but then again, that was the second time I saw it, and I was like, uh-uh, this is going too fast. This man already crazy.
I mean, he was never like intentionally like trying to hurt anybody, but it got to that point midway through. Whereas in this one, like
she
in that
won't
one,
let you leave. Like
at the end,
I
yes,
I am home.
Yeah, no, yes. No.
But like in this one, this was more so of a vein of like, we don't know where he stands. Mm-hmm. We don't know what type of truth. We know that he thinks about the job, and he thinks about figuring, like, finding people out. We learn early on that he doesn't hold any loyalty to anybody, because if somebody has, you know, tried to mess over like a company or whatever, or tried to do insurance fraud, he's gonna find them out.
And he likes it. He finds it fun.
Yeah. And that's like, again, his loyalty is to the job. And so when you have people who have loyalty to their job, they tend to kind of look over people that are close to them, and they're focused on themselves, mm-hmm. which is fine. That's how they choose to operate. And seeing somebody like Sam Neill operate this way was very fun. And it was such a joy to watch. Like Sam Neill bringing the apocalypse unknowingly or knowingly, subconsciously, you know, whether knowingly or unknowingly, bringing about the apocalypse and recanting about it while having crosses with black crayon on his face while telling this was like one of the most spectacular things I've seen. With his little cigarette, yes. And it's so great to see him. And again, yes, the soundtrack was phenomenal. Yes, the practical effect work in this movie was outstanding. Even some of the CG work, for it being earlier on, 1995, you know, you had some of that CG work looking great. And I loved it. You know, but again, every aspect about this movie, the writing was so well put. Some of those, you know, quotes straight from H.P. Lovecraft right into this movie felt like it fit, but it also felt like a highlight. And it's kind of difficult to say those, but it's like, yeah, you know, I enjoyed it. I really did. And that does bring us to our roundtable question of the evening.
But I had a gripe.
Oh, you do? Oh, I'm sorry.
I thought you were getting
your gripe has been denied, right?
We got this far.
I need to talk about it. Julie Carmen, you did not need a Mac up on Sam Neill. Just like, don't you love me? Like, that was so weird. It was so out of pocket.
That was the madness.
That was the madness.
Fire. Remember, they got to the hotel room. They
Mrs. were still Pickman was chained to her husband.
No, this was naked. He was like on the floor. She's like, shut up.
And he was naked and on the floor.
But this was after she was driving through the sky.
No. It was exactly. After she was driving through the sky. Again, but before all these explanations, she went crazy.
All these explanations make sense. No. It's like, this would drive anybody mad. Stop. Be like, I need yeah. something.
No. Okay.
So like she was going mad already. Like you seem to be putting a line of like, well, she needs to be at least this mad to not.
Right.
It was the fact that she was like super duper normal.
She literally hit somebody with her car and they got up and rode off into the darkness. Like, what logical...
With their hair floating gently behind
them. Which point of do you think logical reason was still a part of her...
No, it was just it so... Because the whole thing was, she's like, listen, this is what's happening. And it so was, we're like, wait,
you were going to say, it was so what? It was so...
Random.
You mean it was so mad?
No.
Like, it was just crazy?
No.
Like, where the rest of the people were at in this movie? Yeah. I got nods from Spencer. You're kind of outnumbered on this one. Sorry, sweetheart.
No, but, this is, if the insane were the majority, then yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, so you agree. You are insane. Got it.
100%. And speaking of insane, here is our roundtable question of the evening. So I know this will never happen because I hope and I pray to God this won't. But for the sake of fun, let's see what we think. If Hollywood greenlit a reboot of In the Mouth of Madness, who's directing or who would you choose as director and or starring as John Trent? You could either give me the director or the starring actor, or you can give me both if you have one on hand.
I don't like it.
I don't really like it.
I don't like this. I think the
biggest... Speaking of madness.
No, it's not maddening in this regard. I really don't know anybody that could... That could take on H.P. Lovecraft for a reboot in the way that this was done so well. And I don't think we have another Sam Neill-esque person that I would like to see. I mean, a gimme to me if I was going to do a John Trent would be... I just saw him in a movie. Oscar Isaacs. Like, he would be a good John Trent because he can do that flex. But however, I don't know anybody that I would want to direct in that type of space. Simply because this movie is a thing in and of itself and of its own. And I am okay with that staying there.
Spencer.
Okay. I've got a director, but like, I also... Like, I've never seen him do something like a cosmic horror. He's more in regular grounded horror. And so I don't know how this would translate.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But maybe we'll see something interesting if Jordan Peele takes a shot at it.
Oh. Hey.
Like, it could be interesting because he's also going to try to tie it back to, like, humanity and, like, have a point. But I don't know how, like, you're going to be like, it was a big giant spaghetti monster type thing. Blah, blah, blah. Like that's.
Wait, he's already done that, Spencer. Remember? Nope.
Oh yeah.
It looked like a flower.
Looked like a jellyfish.
Yeah. A flower. It looked like an orchid.
Okay, so nope, but with you know, it's not one alien and it's attacking everyone.
Okay.
We're all gonna die.
I have my director and my performer.
Okay.
So. Obviously, my director of choice has to be Guillermo del Toro, without a doubt, like 100%.
The man loves gothic horror, not cosmic.
It's going to be a gothic cosmic horror.
I mean,
See, here's the problem. Because that's originally where I went, and I was like... That beautiful, beautiful, beautiful man. I just, whatever he wants. If he wanted to reboot, I would say fine. But he's got other things on his mind right now.
True.
And so I want to give him all of those options.
But
so
I'm just saying, like, I mean, this could be pitched out there and be like, he does it in 2 years. I'm like, I don't know. But my performer, my actor, just because I know he's capable of doing something like this. I have seen him in similar roles and he hasn't revisited it in a while. But I just, oh my God, I really do believe
in Sean this, Bean.
No. For the role of an insurance auditor who slowly is presented as now the bringer of the apocalypse, I would want Domhnall Gleeson. Like, I would just love for him to come in as this unassuming, like, okay, I'm going to do this. It's my job. I got to do this, blah, blah, blah. And we get
so
to point.
He's so pale as it is.
Yes.
Him and his little like black crayon. He could color his hair.
Yep.
Oh my lord.
I feel like that would be the perfect John Trent, like.
But the and you could literally he would start trembling like a chihuahua when he starts going crazy. That's the problem. Like he wears the movement to insanity so much on his face already in other things that it's just automatic. Like, you're going to just see it.
And when I think of him, like, especially in this role, I think of, like, the innocence of him in that episode of Black Mirror.
With Haley Atwell. Yeah, yeah, I knew exactly where you were going with that one.
Where I don't know if you've ever seen Black Mirror.
Not a lot of it.
So there's an episode. Have you seen the episode with him in it?
No.
So in the episode, Haley Atwell and Domhnall Gleeson are married. And they just moved into their brand new house. And I believe she had just found out that she was pregnant. Mm-mm. No?
Not yet? No, okay. It's before she even finds out she was pregnant.
So either way, mind you, take into a note, like, this takes place like a little bit further into the future, but into a realistic future. She ends up finding out so he ends up getting into a car accident on a rainy night and dies. So she's by herself. She ends up getting recommended by someone that she could sign up for the service where she could send all of the emails, text messages, and phone calls that they've ever had to this server, and it would build this AI robot that would respond to her in like manner.
And call her, text her.
No, email. That was additional. Because
the calling was actually the emails were regular.
Like, and she could pay more, and they would make a voice replication of him. And then it ultimately got to the point to where they could send, so if she paid an exorbitant amount and she sent like DNA samples, that they could actually recreate his physical form in a robot, mind you, that would live for forever, but in a robot form that would ultimately be like him with all that information, all that knowledge downloaded into him. And so she's kind of within this quandary where she does it. He comes back. It's kind of like how it used to be, but then she realizes it's not really. And it's kind of like, but he's in this sense of like innocence where he's like, I just was born. Like, I don't know what's going on, but she's like in this state of postpartum depression from death and like postmortem depression kind of thing. It's crazy. But I say all that to say, like, they're both phenomenal in that episode.
100%. Mm-hmm. I love Haley Atwell.
And Domhnall Gleeson is phenomenal in that role as well. Mm. And that's kind of what I thought about in terms of the beginning part of this movie and how it would fit that particular character type on him in that particular point. Wrapping this thing up, let's go ahead and go around the table and talk about whether or not the film passes or fails, how many monocles, and if we were excited and happy about how we ended off Cosmic Horror Month. So let's start with Amy.
So this film does pass for me. It's John Carpenter, and the longer that I am exposed to John Carpenter films, the more I can see and recognize that his deep and abiding affection for horror is actually how he is communicating to the world what he feels about the world around him and the problems he sees therein. There are lots of examples of that. Especially in this film, he has Sam Neill deliver a line like something like, we destroyed the earth, we've messed with the climate, we've done all these things, why not throw our brains down the drain as well, or something like that. Like, it's very on the nose. And it kind of gives a little view into how he saw the world, especially at that time, but where we're going and where we're headed. The cast is, again, small, but really, really good. And the practical effects are fantastic. So with that, for this one, it actually turns out to be, I think, my favorite one of the month. Thank Yay! God. Thank God. And I'm going to give this a 3.5 out of 5 monocles because I could actually watch it again and not be like crazy. Did you want me to do the thing about if I'm happy that this is where we ended the month?
Yeah,
I am, because I didn't have to watch Hellraiser and I didn't have to. Yeah, I don't want to do Cosmic Horror again. I'm not crying this time, you guys. And we didn't end with Hellraiser and we didn't end with Event Horizon. And this is where I'm just like, Sam Neill is just sitting in a movie theater eating popcorn, watching a flick. He's still there, possibly, ? That's okay. I can do that. Okay. Spencer.
Okay, this movie passes for me. Honestly, I could spend like another hour just gushing about this movie because it was really fantastic and a really fun watch. just like from the acting to like great music to just like the overall story, like there is nothing I really don't like about this movie, and especially with like practical effects. It's always so nice to see good practical effects, even though it was the 90s. I don't care. I still like seeing them. But for
practical
me,
effects and filmed right, is the key 100%.
thing. Yeah, which like I'm kind of glad that we saw like a little bit of those behind the scenes, because like, it really made me appreciate more how this movie turned out, just 100%. Seeing them make it. So, yeah, I think for me, this is going to be like a 5 out of 5. Like, I don't even know what you could do to improve on this movie. I loved it.
Yeah. No, I agree wholeheartedly. I wanted this movie to be the capstone of what we celebrated this month, mainly because of the fact that I recall, again, as I stated earlier, every time I see it, I come in with fresh eyes. And I always remember that I walk away from this movie with a sense of newness and kind of renewed vision in seeing the creative nature of our, you know, of the industry today. This movie is absolutely the gemstone for what people think of when they think of cosmic horror within the cinematic universe of, you know, movies. And of course this movie passes for me. I don't think there is anything about this movie that I would ever want to change. I would hope to God that it would never go for a reboot. And mind you, that was all in jest, so nobody get after us and be angry.
Please, no reboots. No reboots. No, thank you.
But yeah, this is one of those types of movies where you watch and you realize, much like a great book, you can easily revisit this and enjoy it again and again. And even with the sense of seeing new things and seeing the aspect of a different approach to it, I really loved there's a line that one of the individuals in the town says while in the bar with Sam Neill, and he goes, "Reality isn't what it used to be." And it's like, that's such a unique phrase to say in a film that if you didn't know it was about like cosmic horror, you didn't know like the entities that were involved in this, you'd be like, well, okay, that's just whatever. But the fact is, realities change, and the reality in this movie was shifting. And the fact is that nobody knew how it was going to end until it got to the ending. Mm-hmm. And I love that. I love the idea of this movie. I love the fact that you get to the point in this movie where you think it's over and it's not over and there's more. So I have to agree with Spencer. I agree that this is definitely a wonderful movie from John Carpenter. It gets a 5 out of 5 for me. And I don't think that, honestly, I don't think they make movies like that anymore.
No.
So, you know, this is definitely one of those movies that we have to treasure and recognize and behold and say, you know what, people should see more movies like this. So, you know, but this caps off an amazing month of cosmic horror. And I'm so glad you guys were all along the ride with us for this, especially intern Amy getting edumacated in cosmic horror and being able to understand.
Begrudgingly.
This was a great month and a great opportunity to share with you some of our favorite films for the spooktacular month of October. Again, happy Halloween. We hope that you have a great time today and, of course, celebrating over the course of this weekend. Thanks for your show. Up with us and listening in. Again, if you want to check out the rest of our content, head on over to our website at filmlossperspodcast.com. There we got allegedly over 300 episodes, everything from action, anime, comedy, suspense, cosmic horror. If you're looking for it, we got it. Head on over to our website at filmlossperspodcast.com. You can also check us out over at the social pages at facebook.com/filmlossopers and on Twitter, Instagram, and Threads at filmlossophy101. You can also check out all of our special content, our extra content, such as Spencer's Big Score and Amy's Jane on Scene, which can be found where?
The only place this ever lived, which is at Jane on Scene on Instagram and Instagram only. And guys, guess what? Because we've cleared this hurdle, we're going to start streaming Is for Lovers. I'm so excited and scared. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that was quite the drop. You could also check us out over at Blue Sky at filmlossoperspodcast.social over there. And you can also check us out wherever podcasts are streaming, and that's iTunes, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, iHeart, and Amazon Music. Tune into your heart's desire on any one of those platforms. Look for us there at The Filmlosophers. Give us a like or a subscribe and listen in. Tell us what you think. What was your favorite cosmic horror film? What is one that we could have put on the list and maybe we'll put on the list next month?
No.
Let us know in the comment section. And if you like what you hear, give us a 5-star review. We've earned it.
We have.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. We have.
Again, we want to wish everybody a happy Halloween and a wonderful time as you celebrate. Be safe, be mindful, and just have a great time out there. So from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
I'm managing intern manager Amy.
Happy Halloween and class dismissed.